Thanks, Mache, for making me cry. I'm Summer, and I am an alcoholic, a drug addict, and I get addicted to anything that is addicting. Hey, y'all, my friends. I don't know many of you, but I do. And I hope today, after I get done, you'll feel like you know me a little bit better. I have been sober since April 3rd of 2013. And so my birthday is on Wednesday. No fronts, though. I keep hearing that from people. So the past almost 6 years has been quite the journey, and we'll get to that. When I share my story, I like to share what it was like, what happened to me, and how I decided to get sober, and then what it's like now. So I am 28 years old now, and I was born in Corpus Christi, Texas, to two wonderful parents that didn't like each other very much. And I moved down to the border of Texas and Mexico in McAllen, Texas. Some of y'all may know where it is, some of y'all may not, but I lived very close to Mexico. And I had a pretty, well, in my skewed perception, normal childhood. But I was really happy. I felt happy. I felt confident and comfortable. And I guess I just thought it was normal that everyone's parents fought, you know. And so my parents split up when I was about 5 or 6. My mom got with my stepfather, and my dad got with my stepmother. So at a certain point in my life, I had 4 parents. And that was so cool. I had step siblings. I got to be at a different house every other weekend. It was fun. I did great in school. I was in the Gifted and Talented program, which I'm sure a lot of people in this room were. Seems to be pretty normal to find brilliance among addicts and alcoholics. And it's a blessing and a curse. So apart from all that, you know, everything was normal up until my first trauma happened. And I was 9 years old when my stepfather got into a car accident and died. And he was like a dad to me. He had been around for years. He was, I was big in his family. And my mom was absolutely devastated. And basically from that point on, I felt like a little bit like I was taking on a parenting role sometimes. And they had only been married a year. If you ever hear my mom talk about my stepdad, that was her soulmate. And she's never been remarried since then or anything. So it's been, you know, almost 20 years now, but it still is like it was yesterday. I dealt with that, you know. It was okay. I went back to school, and I just dealt with it how I knew, and went to counseling, and I was okay. And but I started, like, acting a little weird. I started acting out in school. I started getting addicted to the thrill and the rush of getting in trouble. So I'd hang out with these boys, and we'd do ridiculous things. And sometimes they'd bring, like, porn magazines to school. And it was crazy. And I'd get caught with them. And it was, like, such a thrill and a rush to me. And it didn't even, you know, it hasn't occurred to me until within the past couple of years that that was probably one of the first signs of my alcoholism and addiction, was feeling thrills from partaking in stuff that I wasn't supposed to. And so a year after my stepdad died was my next trauma. And my dad got in trouble for, well, he got charged with molesting my stepsisters. So that was, obviously, we got taken away from him, and I didn't see him anymore after that. And we moved back to Corpus Christi. And that's kind of where my drug addiction started. That is absolutely where my drug addiction started. I was okay until I hit puberty, and then it all went downhill from there. I got hit with like depression, and I didn't know how to handle it. And my mom was not present. She was in school, doing night school. She just wanted to get away. So, I started getting addicted to my friends, and, I was hanging out with my friends all the time. And before you know it, we're all smoking weed and we're all drinking. And I cannot explain the level of elation that I would feel when I was around these people and I was high or I was drunk. It was absolutely incredible. And I had thought I had found the key to the universe. And my mom just didn't understand me. You know, my mom, you know, she's like, you can't hang out with those people. You can't be doing drugs. And I'm like, Mom, but you don't understand. I'm really like it. And come on. So I had several addictions going at one time. It was a really good melting pot of crazy going on. I was cutting myself. I was smoking cigarettes. By like 14 years old, I was smoking a pack a day of cigarettes. I don't know. I can't not remember how I was getting a pack a day. Possibly Mache can tell me. We were collecting quarters or something and then standing on the side of gas stations and asking men to buy us cigarettes. If literally anyone did that to me now, I'd be like, go away. But guys were like, yeah, sure, I'll get you some cigarettes, little sweetie. I'm like, no. So, smoking my cigs, and, you know, I start getting in really big trouble at school, and I was still in the gifted and talented program, but they kicked me out of that, because I just was not showing up. I was not doing my work. They're like, you're not challenged enough, and it's like, well, I just don't want to be here. So I went to normal school, whatever they call it, you know, it's so weird that they have those separations. But in eighth grade, I was in school suspension for 87 days out of the school year. And by ninth grade, I started to find blackout drinking. And so right after my 15th birthday is when I started getting completely blackout drunk, and I fell in love. It was absolutely magical to know that there are substances on this planet that could disappear me for hours. And I don't know if any of y'all have ever blacked out before, but it's if you're into that kind of stuff, it's the thrill of a lifetime. Yeah, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd have to be my own detective, you know, like, oh, what happened last night, guys? Trying to make phone calls and, you know, asking around, just not knowing where my stuff is or where I've been. And it was wild. And I was addicted, absolutely addicted. It's not just the substances that I get addicted to. It's the actions, and it's the things that happen when I'm surrounded by it or by people that are doing it. And, my mom, she started noticing me, and within a month of me blackout drinking for the first time, she put me into treatment when I was 15. So I went to three behavioral hospitals for 2 to 3 week stints in the beginning of the year of 2006. And the fourth treatment center I went to was a drug and alcohol treatment center. And, it was amazing. I fit right in. So I have always fit in with alcoholics and addicts, no matter if they're sober or if they're drunk. That's just, my brain works the same as y'all's. So I've always felt like family. And, the difference between me when I'm in treatment and I don't want to be there is I'm sticking with the people that aren't wanting to be there either. And when I'm in a treatment center and I'm wanting to be there, I'm sticking with the winners. And when I'm going to meetings and I'm wanting to be there, I'm with the winners. My friends are all in their very active in their recovery. And you know, we just look out for each other. So I was in treatment for 2.5 months at a girl's home. I had this wonderful lady called Miss Pat. And, I wish I could call her. I don't know where she is or what, but I'm so grateful for her. She changed my life. I read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I read the book of Narcotics Anonymous. And you know what? I just couldn't vibe with the thought of never drinking or using again. So I could kind of understand like not doing it during the week, but like at least on the weekends, you know, letting me drink or whatever. I couldn't understand at all what they were saying in the big book. But I knew that it was a book that was meant for me in a way. So I got kicked out of that treatment center eventually, and I went to 2 more treatment centers after that for a little short time. Actually, here in Austin, went to Shoal Creek and Phoenix Academy. Yeah. Yeah, I went to Phoenix Academy, which was like a, you know, teenage rehab, and I found out since it's a therapeutic community that if you tell them that you're going to kill yourself, they'll send you to the psych ward, and I really like the psych ward, so they give you way more meds there. So I got out of all these treatments, and I went back home, and my mom was like, we need to get you out of Corpus. I figured it out. She's the perfect Al-Anon, right? She's like, I figured it out. It's Corpus, Christy, that's doing this to you. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to move you back down by Mexico, where all the drugs are. And you're going to be good down there, okay? Whoa, no, not the case. Within the first week of me living in back in McAllen, I ran away to Mexico because I was a chronic runaway. That's how me and always a runaway, always a runaway. So I went to Mexico. I ran away to Mexico, and then I went back to Corpus, and then the cops got called on me, so I got taken home. That was pretty normal for me. I don't know how many times I got picked up by the cops, but I was 16 at this point, and I was back in ninth grade again, and I got introduced to Rohypnol, which was really a big drug down in the valley at the time. Rohypnol is date rape. And so it's the, you know, number one blackout drug in the universe. And that's right up my alley because I don't want to know what's going on for days. So I did that. And I got hooked on that stuff for like a year. I literally don't remember like a year or two of my life because of that stuff. And it's crazy. I'd wake up in places. I'm just lucky to be alive. Just from that drug addiction alone, that was like really short. I went to places, I hung out with people, and I did things that I cannot comprehend at this point. I can't associate myself with that anymore because it's so far away from the way I live my life today. So eventually my mom helped me, thank goodness, to get my GED, which I did at 16. And after that, it was off to the races, man. I started working in strip clubs at the age of 17, which was the perfect fit for me because people just hand you money and they were letting me drink and I could buy cigarettes out of a vending machine. I didn't have to ask at the corner of the gas station anymore. And that was my next high, was utilizing men and women for my resources, for my money. And that lifestyle was not a big part of my trauma, and it definitely taught me a lot, and I think at times might have saved my life because I wasn't on the streets doing crazy stuff. I was in like a safe, bodyguarded environment being crazy. So I, you know, had my own apartments and started my journey through like hallucinogens, and that was wild. You know, my brain is probably melted in some parts. And I just kept going like that. It just was always what's next, always what's coming. I found a boyfriend that was in the military, and he went to Iraq, and I waited for him for a year. And then he came home, and I moved up here. I moved up to, Fort Hood. And I lived there for a little while until I didn't want to be with him anymore after like 4 months. And I moved down to San Antonio, where I started my life in San Antonio. That's how I landed there. Eventually, I came back into contact with my father, who, I don't know if you guys remember, but at the beginning of the story, he had gotten in trouble. And he got really sick, and I forgave him, and we became really close. So that was one of the most magical things in my life. I have been blessed with great relationships and great family, and, well, not a lot of family, but mostly friendships. I've been blessed with a lot of friendships in my life, and the ability to forgive, and people talking sense into me, and people protecting me and taking care of me. So I, at the age of 21, I got a new boyfriend, and he was a Cuban, and he was 12 years older than me, and he was a career criminal, a very scary man. And I thought, that's my man. So I tried to wrangle him in, and it worked, you know. So we, me and him, we fled the valley because I moved back to the valley for a time. We fled the valley because the FBI and the DEA were watching us, and we went up to Colorado, where we proceeded to get pulled over 2 times by undercover agents. So we came back to San Antonio with our tail between our legs and decided never to do anything illegal again, and lived in hotel rooms. And it just was getting worse and worse. Being with him, we were very volatile, and we liked to party. And sometimes we'd get so drunk, we'd be yelling at each other back and forth. And it got so dark that I actually did it. You guys are going to know what I'm talking about. You ever seen that commercial that says, if you're an addict, call this 1-800 help me hotline? I was that desperate that I called that. So I met a really, really, really awesome man over this hotline. I think it was American Addiction Centers. And, he was so worried about me, guys. And, I told him I didn't have any money. I told him to call my mom. My mom literally didn't want to talk to me anymore. That was where we were at. So, there was no money for me to go to rehab. There was nobody going to help me. And Cliff said, hold on, I'm going to call you back. And this was in December of 2012 or November. And he calls me back, and he got me a full ride scholarship into a treatment center in California. And the only thing I had to pay for was my flight. So I hear this information, and I start to roll it around in my mind. And I'm like, oh, man. So I have this free ride to treatment, guys. You know, I'm at a party, and all my friends are there. And my friends are like, dude, you don't need treatment. You're not an addict. You can quit whenever you want, as we're all sitting there drinking and snorting lines of drugs. So I believed them because I was obviously not ready to believe with every single ounce of my being that I was an addict. And I had to make one of the weirdest and saddest phone calls of my life to tell this guy that I was returning this priceless gift to him, this life-saving gift. I'm sure he thinks I'm dead. So I get this job bartending. This is the last hurrah of my addiction. I get this crummy job bartending, right? I'm having fun doing it, and I'm starting to feel comfortable there after a few months. So I started doing Xanax there. That was my drug of choice. So it was a really, it worked, right? So I'm doing bars, and I start giving away drinks, and I get fired from this hole-in-the-wall bar. And that, I went through a lot of arrests. I went through a lot of times being in the hospital and being detained, and lots of sleeping outside and stuff. But for some reason, just the accumulation of everything up to this point, my ego was hurt. My pride was hurt. I got fired. You know, I couldn't even hold a job. So one day, I don't even remember it, I called my mom, who I hadn't talked to in over a year. And she took my call. And I said, "Mom, I need to go to rehab." And she was very reluctant with me for a moment. And finally, she said, "Okay, look up one and let's do this." And I couldn't even see straight to look at my phone. I couldn't focus. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't do anything. I could only lay in bed and do drugs. So I got this phone call from my mom. She called me back pretty shortly after that. And she's like, "Okay, you're going to rehab on Tuesday." And I was like, "Wait, that is too soon." It was like Sunday or something. Like, wait. So I reluctantly agreed to going to this $20,000 a month treatment center that, you know, it's like, I just feel like such an entitled brat looking back on all of it. So my last drunk, one of the things that I've heard from an old timer in my AA club in San Antonio is that most people in successful sobriety never forget their last drunk. And that last time getting drunk, it encompassed all of my bad behavior of like 10 years of being a fuck up. So I got blacked out. Step one of my addiction. I fought with someone. I drove. And it was all alcohol, right? I spent so much time thinking I'm a drug addict, but the last drug I ever did was alcohol. So everything was darkness up to this point. My memory is clouded. I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel, per se. And I go up to treatment. It's April 2nd of 2013. My friends drive me up there. Kerrville. I went to Starlight. And I felt crazy. It had been 7 years since I had gone to treatment as an adolescent. This was my first time as an adult, and it was my only time that I've ever wanted help myself and wasn't forced there. So I get there and I walk in. It's nighttime. It's kind of raining outside. And I open the doors and these bright fluorescent lights are like beaming down on me. And then before I know it, these two girls waddle up to me and they're high on Seroquel and Trazodone. And they're like, "Hey, man. Welcome to treatment," you know? And I was like, "Oh my gosh, these are my people." So I walk up, you know, I get checked in. The lights are, I just can't, I'll never forget the lights, how bright they were. And it was so shocking. It's almost like from that day forth, I opened up the door to let God in. I had a beautiful experience in treatment, unlike the other times that I had gone. I was probably really annoying to the people that I was in treatment with because I was so excited. I finally got the concrete out of my ears. I had read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I read it in treatment. I read it high. I went to AA meetings. I could literally not understand what the steps were telling me. I didn't get it. I didn't get it. But somehow, after April 2nd of 2013, I understood everything. It was explained to me in ways that I could understand. My brain was absorbing it. I was healing. I was ready. I had been so desperate up to that point. It had gotten so dark that I was able to hear what was going on. And I absorbed every single moment that I could. I read my big book, almost had it attached to my hands while I was there. I gave my life to God like a week into being there, and I did it by myself. I went outside and I didn't have a sponsor, so I didn't really know what I was doing. And I sat there and I was like, okay, I'm going to do the third step. And I had an experience where I felt like I was lifting the weight that was on my shoulders, weighing heavy on me for years. And I took it and it was gone. And I would get on my knees every single day, several times a day, in my little dorm room with my little twin size bed, and I'd beg God to keep me sober. I was terrified. I had been traumatized. Drugs and alcohol were going to take my life. They had already taken the pleasure from my life, and I was going to die because of them. And I had finally found some ounce of pleasure here in treatment. And I saw hope for the first time, and it was beautiful, and it was spectacular, and it was amazing. And I vibed with the people so much that I was in treatment with. And I stood up for service commitments. I became the president of, I know it's such a dorky thing. Like, I was the president for a week at the rehab. So I did like the chairing the meetings and stuff. And like, the accomplishments up to that point in my life were not very much. So that was like a huge deal. My name was on the board and stuff. They voted for me, you know? So that was my first experience with like a service commitment. I did my fourth and fifth step in rehab with a girl that lived in Kerrville. I don't even remember her name. She came down to the treatment center and met me, and she had like 9 months sober. And I read her my, you know, it was not really the best fourth step. It was the best I could do. But I read that to her, and I thought, man, I'm killing it. I felt so good. I finally felt proud of myself. Like, okay, I have some purpose. I have some unity and fellowship. And I was so excited. I picked up my 30 days. Before I left, my counselor, she told me that I needed to go to sober living. And that was the biggest, most foreign words to me that I'd ever heard in my life. I did not understand what sober living was. I didn't even understand like what a halfway house was, like when people get out of jail. I didn't know any of this, okay? So this lady is telling me I need to go live in sober living because I'm still with my Cuban boyfriend. And we are obviously not healthy together. And so I moved into an Oxford house. I'm not sure if all of y'all know what Oxford is, but Oxford, another piece of the puzzle that saved my entire life. I did a phone interview with 8 women that were living in this house in Leon Valley, San Antonio. And my being on the phone with 8 women doing an interview is like the scariest thing you'll ever do. And they just loved me. Those women loved me, and I was so lucky to get into a Oxford house that had such good recovery going on, because it can be a hit or miss with those places. But I got in with these big shots that were, you know, running the game in San Antonio Oxford homes. I was so lucky. I got mommed to death, and people saw me, you know, my age, and if they were older than me and they were barely getting into recovery, they were putting their wings around me because they were terrified, you know. So first thing I did when I got out of the treatment center and got home to my new sober home is I looked up meetings, and the first place that popped up is this place called Winners Club. And it is like Winners Club, man, If any of y'all ever go to San Antonio and you get the opportunity to go to a AA club, Winners Club is spectacular, phenomenal, amazing. Can never say enough good words about it. I walked in there and I was home. It was like God was laying down these stones in front of me, and I was just going where he was telling me to go. So I would go to meetings 3 to 5 times a day sometimes before I got a job. And I just knew that I couldn't do anything the way that I had been doing it before, because that shit doesn't work. So I had to do 100% opposite of that and do stuff that people were telling me to do. If you know me, I don't like it when people tell me what to do at all. But at this point, I was so desperate, and that is why they call it a gift of desperation. You have to be extremely desperate to go against everything in your addict and alcoholic mind in order to do a program of recovery. It's not fun. It's not cute. It's not comfortable, but it's literally saving your life. And you struggle. In the first couple years of sobriety, your brain and body are going through so many changes. You need to stick close to safety. Our habit is to do drugs and drink alcohol. We have to stay away from them. We have to be careful. We have to treat this thing like the most precious thing in our lives, because it is. Without it, we literally have nothing else. I literally can't keep a job. People don't like me as much. My mom stops talking to me. I go to jail. I would not be alive right now. No doubt in my mind. So I did intensive outpatient for 8 weeks. I was going to meetings. I got a sponsor. I started chairing meetings. And I dove right in, man. And so 67 days into my sobriety, I got some news. And this news has set up the rest of my sobriety to kind of show me that I can handle anything that happens to me in sobriety. You can go through literally anything in your sobriety and you make it through sober. Anything that comes your way and you think you can handle it, you can. And the program will help you, and your fellowship will help you. And the men and women of this program will take your hand and they will guide you through, and you'll be okay. Maybe sometimes you're going to have to check yourself in. That does happen. And maybe sometimes, you know, you're going to have to go to therapy. That's more likely. Or you're going to have to go to more meetings, or you're going to have to change stuff. But you can get through anything in sobriety. So I had gotten back into contact with my dad, and me and him got very, very close. And so he was like one of my best friends. And he wrote me a letter every single day when I was in rehab this time. And I got a phone call that he passed away. And I had just been talking to him like a few hours before that. And so I had to get on a plane and go to where he lives and help my half brothers pack up his apartment and speak at his funeral and mourn him. And you know where the first place I went was after I got that information? I went to AA. And I went to a meeting. And then when I got off the plane, I went to AA. And that's why I'm still here today. So I got some cool jobs in early recovery. I worked with other people in sobriety. I worked at a vape shop selling vapes, you know, slanging them vapes. There was like 8 or 9 of us working in recovery at this place. And it was sick. We lived right next to Club 12, which is like a really big AA club in San Antonio. And we'd have people coming through there all the time. So I was surrounded by it, man. God put me in the middle of it. Thank you, God. And I just was having fun, finally. I felt not like shit about myself. I was making a paycheck. I was holding a job. And then at a year sober, my second sponsor, she asked me if I would help her open up some sober living homes. And so I was her first house manager because I had been living in Oxford. She knew I had some experience. And so I got to help open up a sober home at 23 years old. And it was a bunch of older women. And when you're 23 years old and you're trying to tell people that are older than you what to do, that are addicts and alcoholics, you're not going to really get a good response. So I had to learn a lot. I went from living in Oxford where it's like democratically run to being the manager of a house. And the dynamic definitely changes 100%. So I learned how to work in this industry. And then eventually I moved out of there. So I lived in sober living for a total of 2.5 years. And at the end of that, I got a job at a treatment center. And from when I was in treatment, my biggest goal seems like, you know, it's like, oh, yay. But my biggest goal was to work in a treatment center as a tech. And I wrote this cover letter that was like pristine. Like, you know, I was like, I do all this in recovery and this and this. And like, you know, I just so wanted it. So I was buttering them up to give me the job and they did. And I was so excited. You know, I got this job at a rehab. I was driving drug addicts around, talking to them all day, checking their apartments, giving them toilet paper, giving them urine tests. And it was like my dream job. I don't know why it's so fun to like have all the addicts standing in a line, handing them a pee cup. You're like, hey guys, here you go. So, I had that job for like a year, and then I got a job at this over the phone peer counseling company where I would, make phone calls to people just getting out of treatment and their families. And I did that for 2 years and I recently just quit that job. So, the biggest thing I think that I learned from that portion of my life, and because I had no idea, right? I was getting years of sobriety and, I still was just thinking about the alcoholic and the addict, but there's a whole other side of this community that is family. And I had to learn about that. And I feel like I learned what I'm actually like from the eyes of people that are experiencing us. You know, we are so selfish and self-centered and we blow through people's lives like tornadoes and we're so sick that we don't take a second thought about it, right? And that job taught me about that. I had to hear a lot of stories and talk to a lot of parents, talk to a lot of husbands, talk to a lot of wives, and just hear the experiences there. And wow. There are family programs, and I'd suggest, you know, anyone interested, go check them out. Family programs like Al-Anon, Nar-Anon, they're awesome. So I continued to stay with that Cuban boyfriend up until the end of last August. We stayed together for 6.5 years and he supported me through a lot of my recovery. And, but we just weren't, you know, it just wasn't meant to be. So I finally bit the bullet and I broke up with him. And, I knew that if I had tried to do this earlier on in my recovery, it wouldn't have gone so well for me. I decided to leave the country. So I broke up with my boyfriend and I bought tickets to Costa Rica. This was the second time I solo traveled to Costa Rica in recovery, but I was there for 2 months and I got my yoga teacher certification. And yoga is the newest thing in my sobriety, the newest thing in my life. And I'm talking to you guys at a darker time in my sobriety. And I'm really grateful that I've been given the opportunity to come here and share my story today, because it gets me out of myself. It lets me give you guys a different perspective on what sobriety can be like. And I really hope that something I said here today gets through to somebody. And if not, that's okay, you know. So I went to Costa Rica for a few months. I got back. I struggled, and it's been interesting. The past few months has been very interesting. I finally got my own apartment. I got my very first apartment a month ago. I was literally didn't know where I was going to live. I was just staying with my best friend in the midst of a mental breakdown. And, you know what? It's proven to me over the years, time and time again, no matter how far I fall, I have built a fellowship around me of people that are there for me no matter what I do. And they call me to check on me. I call them to check on them. And then when I'm not calling them, they're getting worried. So they're calling me. And so if you do that for yourself, if you watch your own back in recovery, because that's what it's about. You got to watch your own back while you're clear, while you have some clarity in your sobriety. Watch your own back. Make friends, you know, help people so that when you're not doing okay, because alcoholism and addiction is insidious. It lives in our brain and it's not going away. When you're not doing okay, people will reach out to you. So I am so grateful for rehab, for sober living, for intensive outpatient, for the therapists that have helped me, for my family, for my friends, for the just everything about 12 steps it just blows my mind. I'm so grateful for being able to share my story with you guys today, and hope I get to meet some of you after this. So thank you for letting me share.